Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Fiscal year 2020 is quickly approaching. Coming back from the 4th of July break, policymakers have about 3 months to finish the appropriations process, and Congress has fewer and fewer legislative days to set new spending levels in order to avoid a $125 billion or 10% reduction in discretionary spending. But much-needed bipartisan compromise has been hard to come by on both the spending limit and appropriations bills. Congress and government agencies may be looking at a continuing resolution to extend spending levels from 2019 or face yet another government shutdown. The Bipartisan Policy Center has warned that the government runs the risk of default on its debt in early September if the debt limit is not increased by then. BPC said October remains the most likely time when the Treasury would run out of funds provided by extraordinary measures to keep from reaching the debt limit. But a decline in corporate tax revenue has helped increase the risk of default earlier. With Congress on recess in August, it could accelerate the need to reach agreement on the debt limit and new spending levels. The Trump administration is appealing a court decision that $2.5 billion from a Pentagon counter-drug account cannot be rerouted to build border barriers. A U.S. district court issued a permanent injunction against the government in two cases on June 28th. Thus, the legal battle continues, which is rooted in the administration's attempt to reroute $6.7 billion in funding for a border wall after Congress only approved $1.3 billion for such spending. The White House planned to use $3.6 billion from military construction accounts, $2.5 billion from Pentagon counter-drug programs, and $601 million from the Treasury Department's Asset Forfeiture Fund to construct the barriers. The legality of the Affordable Care Act will be under increased scrutiny this week when the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals hears oral arguments on a case seeking to overturn the law on the basis that it should be considered invalid because there's no longer a penalty for failing to purchase health insurance. A federal judge previously ruled in favor of the states seeking to eliminate the ACA, but it remains in effect while under appeal. Depending on the result, the case could end up going before the U.S. Supreme Court. The fate of the ACA has major implications on the state and cost of health care throughout the nation. The federal budget deficit was $746 billion in the first 9 months of fiscal year 2019, which is already $139 billion more than the same period last year. By comparison, last year's total budget deficit was $779 billion. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith will join me to discuss our latest grassroots-focused issue brief. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Phil.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you both on the show since I work with you and you're colleagues of mine. But I thought it would be a good time to talk about something that Concord recently redeveloped or gave an update to, and that was an issue brief oriented toward the presidential primary, so both use for grassroots efforts with voters as well as candidates.
And maybe one of you could give us a quick summary of what that guide entails and how it could be used.
Okay, I can do that. The issue guide is focused around one question for the candidate. If you are elected president, what will you do to address the national debt? And then we very helpfully provide some information about key issues that will affect the debt in the next presidential term. Issues such as the future of healthcare spending, the future of Social Security, the future of revenues and investment spending. And, there's another section that just looks at the difference between debt and deficits, because sometimes people get confused about those terms, and also how the debt affects the economy in the long term. And lest one thinks that this is some 500-page tome that looks like the phone book, it's actually only a few pages long. We try to boil things down to the essence and give a couple of illustrative facts that people can use to help make the case and to help understand how all of these various things fit in. It doesn't take any particular partisan point of view or ideological point of view. It just says, here are the facts, here are the issues. Everything we're doing now doesn't add up. So the deficit is on a long-term, unsustainable path. So is that important to you? And if not, why not? And if so, what would you do about it?
And we've been around now, the Concord Coalition, for more than a quarter of a century. So this isn't our first presidential election, right? And we've seen the need for voters to be educated on federal budget issues. And, of course, that's the primary reason for our existence, is to educate Americans about these issues. So this national debt and federal budget presidential election issue guide is such a great way to come up to speed on these issues. And, you know, Chase, in one way, shape, or form, we've had something like this, I think, some iteration of it going way back. I can remember being in New Hampshire in 96. I can remember the 2000 election. I had a chance to use information like this to interact and have a full-on conversation with a fellow named George W. Bush about these issues. So, you know, when you're in your neck of the woods, you just never know who you're going to run across. So it's good to be prepared and to have some really good information for some solid, substantive questions. And that's what this does.
And actually, that feeds right into the question I had in my mind. I have an idea of how this can and should be used as a voter and someone attending events. Do you have some particular examples of how, besides what you just mentioned, Phil, how can voters grab hold of this and use it to their advantage throughout this election?
Absolutely. Well, of course, you go to our website, concordcoalition.org, and you can download this issue guide. And basically use it. What I would encourage people to do, because it does, you know, it lists lots of different subject matters in here related to the budget, which, you know, we can go through item by item if you'd like. But like if you're really interested in Social Security reform, or you're interested in health care reform, or, you know, what drives the debt, I would suggest that people look into this and not try to memorize the whole document, but try to find one or two key questions so that when you have that opportunity to run across a candidate or talk about these issues with local people. It doesn't even have to be a presidential candidate, by the way. You know, we have people running for Congress, and there's you know, anybody who is interested at about the federal budget, this is a great document to use for them. But I'll give you a more recent example than the George W. Bush. I was down in my home state of Georgia a couple months ago and ran into Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, who, of course, is also one of the many people running for president. And, you know, and I had a chance to basically ask him this question that Bob just referenced. You know, if you're elected president, what will you do to address the national debt? And he immediately told me that he was the best candidate out there on federal budget issues. And I said, really, Senator, why is that? And he said, because when I was mayor of Newark, you know, I had to make all of these really tough budgetary decisions. And that's always been the case, it seems, with municipal people. Municipal leaders really do seem to get budget issues. So we had a good conversation. And, you know, having this information allows people to interact with these candidates and not just, you know, have a quick selfie, which is seems to be what everybody's doing in this election cycle, doing selfies. So I would encourage you to do more than a selfie. Use this issue guide to ask some really good questions.
And Phil, I appreciate that this can be used beyond just presidential candidates. It can be as a point of reference for members of Congress. But to Bob's point, the principal question being asked here, the underlying theme is, if you're elected president, what would you do to effectively address the budget deficit and national debt? And this, in my mind, goes back to an effort we did in 2016 called First Budget, which this particular document is an update of that issue brief. And I wanted to go back to that. Bob, why is the first budget of a new president, why is it important to try and address issues like this or have at least a dialogue or narrative on such issues?
Well, first budgets always set the tone. And when a new president comes in, or a president being reelected, the first budget of that new term really makes a statement. It says, you know, this is where I'm going. Here are the priorities. Here is the electoral mandate that I think that I have won. And so the first budget of a new administration is really important and quite often dominates what happens for the next 4 years. If you look back at, say, the first Clinton budget, that was the first Reagan budget, if you want to go back even further, you know, the first budget of the Obama administration. There are a lot of, or George W. Bush. I mean, some of the budget debates that we have reverberating throughout presidential terms really come from the spending and tax recommendations made in the first budget. So it's very, very important for candidates to put their promises in the context of a budget, which is something that they don't like to do. I mean, let's face it, it's easier to talk about free stuff and cutting taxes. So we get a lot of that rhetoric. And the Concord Coalition is just saying, look, talk about whatever priorities you want. You can have as big a size government as you want. You can cut taxes as much as you want. But remember that it has to fit into some sort of sustainable, responsible budget. And so, you know, the question is, how would you do that given your policy priorities?
And I think one thing I appreciate about this issue brief is it sets the stage for questions that voters can ask or questions that candidates can address, as you both pointed out. And sometimes I'm a visual learner. Sometimes I like listening. So what I would like to do, and Phil, you mentioned that we might do this, I would like to run through the issue brief and some of the major topics within it and give a quick breakdown of some of the facts that are highlighted here, and then eventually get to some of the questions that people could be asking of these candidates. With that in mind, maybe we'll just start with the first segment in this 10-page document, and it's talking about the deficits and the debt. So maybe you could both give a quick rundown of where we are with federal budget deficits and the national debt and what's highlighted in the issue brief.
I mean, basically, this is just giving people an overview of where the debt stands and how it is in historical context. And basically, it's saying that the annual budget deficit is growing. It hit a low point. It's funny to think of this as a low point, of $439 billion in 2015. I call that a low point because that's after the post-recession high where it got really, really, you know, over $1 trillion, mostly because of the recession. So what we're saying is that the budget deficit has now gone up to close to $800 billion, and within a couple of years is headed up to $1 trillion. So that's a bad trend. The debt, which is the accumulation of the deficits, is already at a high point relative to where it's been since the end of World War II. And that's going up as a trend, and it's coming towards record territory. So that's just trying to establish where the deficit is, where the budget is, and where it would be in about 10 years if we do nothing, which is a lot higher.
So basically what Bob is saying is the difference between the debt and deficit is a very important issue to talk about. People sometimes accidentally interchange those two. So just to remind everybody, the debt is the overall accumulation of our annual deficits, right? The deficit is an annual figure. And we've heard candidates who know better, frankly, interchange the two. and so it's very important to know the difference and also to look at the national debt and realize when you're talking about the national debt, you're really talking about the rearview mirror, right? In a lot of ways, I mean, the national debt is where we've been. It's where we haven't had enough money to cover the expenses that we've had. And so as scary as the national debt is, it's actually kind of scarier when you look out into the future and see what the potential national debt could be, particularly if our debt grows faster than our economy.
Before we leave the debt, there's one other little thing that we deal with as summarily as we can, because it greatly confuses things. The national debt is $22 trillion. That's the number that we most often hear. However, most economists measure the debt by the money that we actually have to go out and borrow from the public, from anybody that wants to lend the government money. And that number is lower. That's about $16 trillion. So the difference, that $6 trillion difference, that's money that the government owes to itself in the form of government trust funds, most notably Social Security and Medicare. That's money that it doesn't flow through the credit market. So when you hear people talk about debt as a percentage of the economy, they're usually talking about that lower $16 trillion number. But then when people talk about the total size of the debt, it becomes $22 trillion. And that can get a little bit confusing for people sometimes. So we just sort of explain both numbers there.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and National Field Director Phil Smith. We are discussing an update to an issue brief that both voters and presidential candidates can check out and consider, picking up off of what you were just discussing, Bob and Phil, and that is the debt and the deficit. The issue brief also talks about how the debt might affect the economy. Can you share a little bit of information there for us?
Yeah, this is something that's important for people to focus on. The debt is probably not going to affect us in some sort of big boom crisis with, you know, people jumping out of the windows on Wall Street and stuff like that. I mean, this is a slow, insidious process. If you are constantly running large deficits and debt, and financing that deficit and debt, it's subtracting from public savings that it's needed for investment in things that will help grow the economy. So economists call it crowding out of private investment. What you get over time is a less robust, more stagnant economy and lower standards of living and much higher debt burdens that will have to be paid by future generations. And that's one of the things that scares me the most about this issue is if there was some sort of drop-dead moment, if there was some sort of tripwire that you go over and, you know, it's a red line and everybody knows that that everything's going to just come crashing down, that would be easier to get people's attention. But when you have a slow motion crisis that's not really, it's hard to point to one particular thing in one particular moment. And then you wake up 20 years later and it's like, wow, this is, you know, what did we do? We've got all this debt and the economy's not growing and jobs are, you know, not plentiful and wages aren't going up. And we've lost our standing in the world. That's really what I worry about, is this slow accumulation of debt and the erosion of, frankly, the American dream.
One of the analogies, Chase, that I've heard that kind of describes this American weakness that we have is the wolf at the door versus the termites in the wall. And it seems like when we have a wolf at a door issue, if somebody attacks us, we kind of know how to come together as a nation. We sing the national anthem together, Republicans and Democrats, on the steps of the Capitol. We all come together and we fight. But the issues like this are more like termites in the wall. And the house looks great. In fact, it's probably the fanciest house on the block. But when you put your ears up to the walls, you can hear the termites munching away. And that's a problem. And over time, termites can do just as much destruction as the wolf at the door could. So we need to pay close attention to it. I would also say from an economic standpoint, the economy is very cyclical. And We've been experiencing a very long economic recovery, economic expansion, period of economic growth in this post-recession time. And a lot of economists think that, you know, the recession is on the horizon at some point, and clearly it will be at some point. And when we enter that inevitable recession, hopefully it'll be nothing like the last big bad recession, because that was the greatest recession since the Great Depression. But whatever recession that we enter to next, wouldn't it be better to enter that period of economic difficulty from a period of from a standpoint of fiscal strength and not a standpoint of fiscal weakness? But unfortunately, right now, we're not addressing the debt. We should be fixing the roof while the sun is shining, and instead we're punching holes in the roof right now.
And building off of the theme of this is a slow-growing issue, the termites in the wood, a degradation over time of our fiscal health and standing, the issue brief rolls into next the drivers of the debt. Can you give us a glimpse on what the brief says with regard to why we are where we are in terms of a growing national debt at an unsustainable level?
This is a familiar theme on this program, because it's kind of the guts of the budget dynamic, which is that we have some very large federal programs that run on autopilot and that serve primarily people over 65 and healthcare needs. So Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, to the extent that it benefits the elderly, is those three programs are the leading drivers of the debt, simply because they're the only programs that are growing faster than the economy. Interest grows faster than the economy, too, but I'm talking about just like federal programs here. So the dynamic is, as the baby boomers age, those programs become more expensive. That is not a judgment. I mean, I think it's very, very important for people to think, when people talk about these programs growing and that's the driving factor, I think a lot of people react negatively and say, oh, well, you know, why are you talking about these programs? Because they're so important. And they are important, but the basic fact is that they're becoming much more expensive, and that becomes a budget problem. So it is that, those programs, and now revenues are projected to grow also because of bracket creep and various things. So if we just did nothing, both spending and revenues would grow, but spending grows faster than revenues. And so a lot of the budget debates that we have are quite irrelevant to that. People fight about domestic discretionary spending. It's 17 or 18% of the budget or less, and it's not growing faster than the economy. It's not waste, fraud, and abuse. Obviously, waste, fraud, and abuse is a problem. Nobody's in favor of it. We want to get rid of it. Stamp out waste, fraud, and abuse. But don't kid yourself that means that our underlying dynamic in the federal budget is going to change course.
We spend a lot of time at the Concord Coalition myth-busting. There's so much misinformation out there about the budget, and people misunderstand where we spend our money and where we get our money from. And probably the thing I hear the most out there, and it doesn't matter what region of the country I'm in, is, you know, if we just get rid of that foreign aid, you could solve all of those problems. Well, whether you're for foreign aid or against foreign aid, it is a tiny percentage of our federal budget. And so you can't just say, you know, get rid of that and move on. And to Bob's point about waste, fraud, and abuse, I wish we had a line item in the federal budget for waste, fraud, and abuse, and we just strike it out and take care of that. But again, even though the federal budget clearly has waste, fraud, and abuse in it, there's nowhere near enough of it to take on our big leading drivers of the debt.
And one other point is just that economic growth alone is good, but it's not going to be enough to get us out of the structural mismatch that we have between the major benefit programs and revenues. We are going to have to tackle the tough choices there. Because most of the spending is driven by demographics and rising healthcare costs. So those are really the two big factors we have to grapple with.
And to your point, Phil, it would be nice if waste, fraud, and abuse was a line item. And in fact, you know, candidates and policymakers often talk about it as if it were. If it were that simple, that would be great. But in addition to that, it wouldn't be enough. We wouldn't find enough waste, fraud, and abuse to tackle all of these issues. And I don't want to belabor too much more on Social Security and health care. They're big issues, but we're running short on time. And I want to get to the next couple issues within the brief, and that talks a little bit about taxes and then domestic investments, and that goes a little bit, Bob, to your reference of discretionary spending. So what does Concord have to say in the brief about tax reform and critical domestic investments?
Well, of course, you have to have revenues. Revenues pay for everything that the federal government does, and so the trick with revenues is you have to have a system that collects as much revenue in an economically efficient way so it doesn't harm the economy. And that's always a trick that people fight about, what's the right level. What we focus on in this issue brief is that the level of revenues that are projected over the future is not sufficient to keep up with the level of spending. So you're either going to have to reduce that spending or raise the revenue. And the other thing I'd point out is that people look at the historical average of revenues, say, over the past 50 years or so, and if you look over the next 10 or 20 years, revenues are projected to be about the same or even go up a bit. And so there's a tendency to think, well, why are we even talking about revenues? There's no problem there. The problem is that that historic level of revenues is increasingly insufficient to fund the increased spending, which comes from what we were just talking about, the aging of the population with the rising costs of programs like Medicare and Social Security. So the question, one of the difficulties that people need to focus on is that what we've settled for revenues in the past isn't sufficient for what's projected in the future. And candidates, what do you want to do about that?
Sometimes we hear that we just have a spending problem, and that's not correct. We also have a revenue problem, and particularly as we look to the future, the mismatch is on both sides. And so it's a tough question that needs to be asked of all the candidates, which is, you know, ask the famous Concord Coalition question, how are you going to pay for that? And there's lots of different ways that we could collect revenue that would be better than the current way that we do it. And it was a real missed opportunity for the tax cuts that we had last time, and that they weren't more true tax reform instead of just straight up tax cuts.
Yeah, the phrase I often hear is that we spend like we want a big government, but tax like we want a small government, and that's kind of a problem when and helping generate those deficits on top of the fact that we have a huge demographic shift going on in our country right now. And to wrap up the issue brief, the last section is titled Prioritizing. Well, I guess it's close to the last section. The last section is actually the five P's, the questions that people can actually ask of candidates. But in terms of substance, the last major category in the issue brief is prioritizing critical investments. And prioritizing investments is a big issue on the campaign trail right now. A lot of candidates are talking about their efforts and policies they'd like to see go into place. What does the issue brief have to say about any of that?
Well, it says that the federal government has not done a very good job in recent years in investment. Federal investment spending, things like in infrastructure or basic science, research and development, even things into healthcare or education, things that are likely to have a payoff down the road, have actually been falling as a percentage of the budget and as a percentage of the economy. So it's if they're going to be if we're going to try to invest in a growing economy, we're going to have to look more at what we do on the investment side of the budget. On the other hand, we've got this huge deficit, and so it's not like you can just throw money at a problem and say, well, it's going to pay for itself. So you have to be able to invest in a fiscally responsible way. But basically what we're saying is, here's the phenomenon. The federal budget is showing a declining share of money going to investments more and more of it is just a transfer from, you know, you take money from some people and give it to other people, and without regard to whether or not it's going to have some payoff down the road. So our budget, that's another structural problem within the budget, is declining part of it going to investment.
This is yet another reason why young people need to get educated about these issues. One of many areas that we look at in the budget where young people are getting the short straw, and you know, a healthy economy, both over the short term and the long term, really depends on fiscally responsible infrastructure in so many ways. And so I would encourage people to look closely at this, and that when you hear candidates make big promises, you know, they're talking about this type of infrastructure. So we've got to figure out how to pay for it, and it's got to be fiscally responsible. But they're investments that we truly need.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit before about discretionary spending shrinking as a part of the budget, and that really is a major cause here, particularly if you look at the future, because discretionary spending is projected to actually shrink as a percentage of the economy, and that's where the investments come from. So as that part of the budget gets squeezed by the rising benefit programs and interest on the debt, it becomes a vicious cycle of less investment and a lower economy trying to pay off these higher bills. You really don't have to be an economist to know that that's not a good combination.
And Bob, we're not quite at yet, but we're nearing modern historic lows in domestic discretionary.
As a percentage of the economy, we're already on the low side and headed lower.
And I think since I mentioned them, I'm now obligated to run through them, and that is the five P's. And I'll do it real quick for the benefit of our listeners. One, having candidates acknowledge that a growing debt is a serious problem, making dealing with the debt a top policy priority, putting forward a plan and how they would do it, explaining how they would pay for their new policy initiatives, and using their platform to engage and educate the public. So we got five P's: problem, priority, plan, pay, public.
Very good.
That was the educational takeaway for today. And I would also be remiss. We have our national field director on the line, Phil Smith. It would be silly of me to have you on the show, Phil, and not ask for a quick summary of what we're doing nationwide and what our fiscal lookouts have been engaged in recently.
Well, thank you, Chase. I appreciate that and the opportunity to talk about the field work of the Concord Coalition. We've got a lot going on. In fact, roughly in half the states right now, we've got some sort of activity going on, and we have volunteer leadership in many of these states. We call them our fiscal lookouts. And they're looking out for us and for our mission and for the future of America as it relates to fiscal policy. And we literally have fiscal lookouts from Florida to Maine to Alaska down to California and everywhere in between. I've even been working with one fellow out in Hawaii right now. So we really, really are covering the map. And we've had several recent events lately. We've been doing a lot of work with freshman members of Congress and helping them to conduct town hall meetings on federal budget issues, where we run the famous Concord Coalition experiential federal budget exercise that we call Principles and Priorities. So I've been in Nevada, I've been in Arizona, in Utah, New York, just all over the map working with these freshman members and helping them to educate their constituents and, frankly, educate some of the freshman members, too, about these issues. But really, we have stuff happening all over. In Colorado, we've got an upcoming event in Fort Collins with our fiscal lookout out there. Our fiscal lookout down in Florida, Bobby Monroe, has helped us find some additional funding through the Monroe Family Foundation and to do a project that is near and dear to your heart, Chase, that I'm sure we'll hear more about as we come. So the fiscal lookouts do different things, right? In the case of Bobby, she's been helpful in helping fund some things. So it's not just activities. Out in Minnesota today, our Minnesota Concord Advisory Council is meeting with a freshman member of Congress out there, a guy named Dean Phillips. So we hope to make a pitch to do an event with him. He's a Democratic freshman down in North Carolina. Marjorie Dufek, who is our North Carolina Fiscal Lookout has scheduled one of our principles and priorities exercises with a Republican member, Ted Budd. And then from Texas, we met with several members of the Texas delegation with our Texas Fiscal Lookout when he was in town. And we also have some upcoming events in Georgia. In fact, Leadership Georgia will be hosting our fiscal experiential budget workshop in September with their class. Georgia State University is coming up to Washington in October, so we'll be doing some work with them. And I mean, the list just goes on and on, Chase. We've got continuing to have meetings on Capitol Hill. So it's been pretty active. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that coming up on October the 3rd, we have our annual Economic Patriots Dinner. And many of our volunteers at their own expense travel to Washington to be with us for that event. So the calendar is full and we've got lots of activities, but I'd also welcome any more. So to any of our listeners out there, if you'd like us to come out and do our budget exercise or host a speech at a local Rotary or Kiwanis, just let me know and check us out on our website at concordcoalition.org for more information.
Well, thanks, Phil. I appreciate you doing that quick run through of what we've got going on nationally. And of course, we have events going on in New Hampshire as well. So I'm excited for what we have going on, not just across the nation, but we have going on in the state during the New Hampshire primary. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and National Field Director Phil Smith discuss the issue brief that Concord just recently updated, as well as a quick recap of what Concord has going on at the grassroots level across the country. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
After the break, Bob will return to discuss the Congressional Budget Office's monthly budget review for June and the state of the federal debt limit. We will be back after these messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show once again by Bob Bixby. Bob is Concord's executive director and a regular contributor on Facing the Future. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be back.
Well, I wanted to have a quick segment here on a couple things. One is the Congressional Budget Office's monthly budget review, and then also some recent developments on the federal debt limit. But before we get to the limit, let's talk about the CBO's monthly budget review. Can you give a quick rundown of what the review details in general, and then what it's saying for June of 2019?
Okay, well, there's probably not going to be jolly updates on either subject here, but the CBO monthly budget report, every month they kind of give an update, so it's like a rolling update on how the fiscal year is going month by month, so policymakers and the public can keep track of how things are going and if things are tracking with the way CBO thought they would. And basically, the budget for the first 9 months of the year pretty well tracks with where CBO thought it was going to be, and that's not necessarily good news. But the deficit is about $750 billion for the first 9 months of the year, and that's up about $140 billion from where it was at this time last year. So CBO projected that there'd be a higher deficit this year, and it looks like it's going in that direction. That's made up of spending growing faster than revenues. So revenues have been up by 3% so far this year, but spending has been up by 7%. And so that perpetuates the deficit and actually, you know, makes it a little bit worse. One thing that is noticeable from the trends is revenue growth is actually a little bit slower than CBO projected. So if that continues for the final 3 months of the year, we could actually see a higher deficit for this year that CBO was projecting. And basically, they're projecting about a $900 billion deficit for the total year. And so far, that looks still to be a pretty solid projection, but it may come up a little bit higher than that if the current trends continue. Spending is about what they projected, and that's not unusual. CBO can do a much better job of projecting spending. It seems to be much more predictable than revenues, which is much more affected by the underlying forces in the economy and that sort of thing. So that's the short story is that we are growing, the budget deficit is continuing to grow.
And Bob, you mentioned that it sounded like revenues were coming in a little less than what CBO originally had projected for the year. Is there a particular reason for that? Are we at a point where in the year where perhaps revenue will actually pick up again and we'll see a little bit of a contraction of the deficit? Or are we pretty well far enough along in the year that we're pretty locked in?
Well, we're not going to get a surprise revenue boom, let me put it that way. It could be that you'd get stronger receipts in the final 3 months of the year. But April gives you a pretty good, the spring gives you a pretty good estimate of where you're going to be because people put in their income taxes. And based on that, you get an idea of where you're going to be. And you get corporate receipts that come in and the quarterly receipts that come in June. And so, it's probably, I wouldn't say it's locked in, but it's like I said, it's not going to be a surprise revenue boom.
And does CBO give any kind of update in this report on interest on the debt and how much we're spending and where we're headed in terms of an annual amount on that?
Yeah, when you look at the spending results so far this year, interest on the debt is the fastest growing part of the budget. So it's grown by 16% this year, outlays for interest on the debt. And that's a lot faster than more than twice as fast as the growth rate of other parts of the budget. And that's as the debt grows and if you get higher interest costs, that gets you into a vicious cycle of higher debt and higher interest, and then you have to pay more interest on the new debt that you've rung up. So that's, perhaps not a surprise, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Okay, so let's switch gears to probably an equally depressing topic, and that is the federal debt limit. Depressing for a lot of reasons, but what is the federal debt limit, first of all, and second of all, what's going on with it right now?
Well, Congress has put in law a statutory debt limit. It's been around for a long time. Every now and then they have, and quite often they have to adjust it upward because it's really bogus. I mean, it's a totally meaningless thing that Congress writes into the law to pretend that they're being fiscally responsible. And basically what it says is if you get up to the debt limit and you don't raise it, the government defaults, which everybody thinks would be a bad idea. And everybody knows we shouldn't do that. And so the debt limit is raised. But so there we are. We're coming up on the debt limit very soon. Actually, we're at the debt limit. The only reason we're not over it is that the Treasury Department has the ability to disinvest or not invest in certain of its own trust funds. So it makes it look like the debt is not going up. And then when they raise the debt limit, the Treasury just credits its own trust funds with the new bonds again, and everything's fine. So Treasury has some latitude to play that game for several months, and that's what it's doing now. But everybody understands that the authority to do that is going to run out sometime. The ability to do that is going to run out sometime in September or October. What happened this week is that a nonpartisan think tank called the Bipartisan Policy Center, which tracks this stuff very closely, came out with an alert that said, because revenue growth is slower this year than we were thinking, and the CBO was thinking, we think that this debt limit might actually become an issue sooner than we thought, maybe as soon as early September. And so members of Congress and the president, you're going to have to face a crisis perhaps sooner than you thought, because everybody acknowledges that when you hit that limit, you really have to raise the debt limit. Otherwise, having a default on the debt would be it would not have a good effect, let me say, on the markets or the economy.
And Bob, with the likelihood of the debt limit issue being moved up from, say, October or November to maybe September, that seems to be lining up right when the appropriations process is coming to a close and new spending levels would have to be agreed upon in Congress. Does this complicate things?
It surely does, because Congress is, they already had a complicated problem because they have to pass their appropriations bills by the end of September or the government shuts down. And just to add to the mix, they knew that they had to raise the debt limit as well. So people were thinking, well, we can roll these things together and make it part of a big negotiation. This puts added pressure on them to do that negotiation sooner, because you can shut down the government for a while. The consequences, I mean, I think it's a terrible idea. But, you know, you can survive that. A debt limit crisis is much more severe. And so if they're going to try to do these things together, this means that they probably should move up their timetable, which I think would be a good idea anyway.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the Congressional Budget Office's monthly budget review for June and the state of the federal debt limit this year. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
You're welcome.
You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.